Christine Doza likes to think about the ways we would communicate before there was the internet. She thinks about mixtapes, landline phone calls, dedications on the radio, handwritten letters, and signaling. Messages sent by the things you wore, like buttons or badges, stickers and patches. Then there are zines. Zines can best be described as self-written, self-designed, and self-published non-commercial print works. They're often given away or traded, but can also be sold through the mail or at independent record and bookstores. Zines embody the DIY culture, and before the internet, were the communication tool of choice for many counterculture movements. Zines propelled the Riot Girl movement. Riot Girl started in the early 1990s and was a fierce, outspoken, and unapologetically loud feminist movement whose primary channel for activism was punk rock and all the DIY elements associated with it. By 1993, Riot Girl music, writing, and art had seriously disturbed not only the status quo of the male-dominated punk scene and societal institutions across the country, but also the feminist movement itself. In a few years after that, the original wave of the Riot Girl would be thoroughly demonized and commercialized, but the positive effect it had on girls like Christine wouldn't be erased. Emotionally, Christine was already where the founders of the Riot Girl movement were when it started, but if it wasn't for the Riot Girl zines that dared to address in print issues like rape with the proper amount of rage and sexual and gender identities with absolute acceptance, Christine may never have thought to present her own struggles as a self-written, designed, and self-published print work. She may never have written or published Upslut. Upslut was a burgeoning feminist take on the white male-dominated culture that surrounded Christine at home and at school and in American society writ large. And it was only her beginning. The first issue of Upslut had an immediate impact and elicited a really scary response from one male adult in her life. But Christine never wavered. She said she probably first came to Lucy's to go to a show with somebody she knew, but she ended up staying to sell her zine, connect with other girls, and organize the first Riot Girl convention in Nashville. She learned how to use the soundboard to prevent any men or boys from being involved in the production of that event. But mostly, Lucy's was a place where she just felt like she belonged.
I did go there a lot, and I did shop there a lot, and I did sell my zine there, but I mean, I feel like that my primary relationship with Lucy's wasn't a transactional one. It was really with you. I mean, I think I sought out your friendship and your guidance. And I think it, you know, because you were an adult living in a way that I wanted to live, and I respected and admired you. I think I had a little crush on you.
Aww. That's so cute.
I mean, I remember because we were talking earlier, I was going through photos and of course we didn't all carry around cameras back then, but I don't have a single photo inside of Lucy's. And I think it's because I mostly came alone and just came to like see a show or shop around and just chat with you and see what was up with you. And that's my memory of it, is just it was like a safe place to go and hang out and find new music, and you had books. And I mean, it was so different being at Lucy's versus being at, I don't know, Pan Starship or 328 or wherever else that you could go see shows, which didn't, it just felt, you felt, I felt so much more protected and felt so much more part of a family there. And I feel like people behaved better for the most part.
What was your feminist awakening?
My mother was married and divorced a lot of times, and none of those marriages were healthy, and she was not treated well by any of those men, and neither were my brother or I, for that matter. And I think that was really an awakening of seeing that personally and putting together the pieces that that was also systemic, and starting to read, and the Riot Girl thing popped up just like in the nick of time. And yeah, it was pretty quick from that, just being politicized from my personal experiences.
The Riot Girl movement, you said the Riot Girl movement came in the nick of time. Mm-hmm. But how did you first discover that? Was that at...
That's a great question. It might have been. I don't know what the order of events is, if I was already making the zine before I came to Lucy's, or I saw zines there and realized that I could do it too if these other people were doing it. Like I said, my recall of details and like the order of things is not great. Yeah. But it's some amalgamation of that, of like knowing that was going on, listening to Hole, and then moving in quickly into Riot Girl and Heavens to Betsy and Bikini Kill and all of that. And finding those records there, finding fanzines there, quickly beginning to create my own fanzine maybe, and approaching you, I'm sure, very shyly to ask if I could sell it there. And you were very encouraging.
That's funny, because there's nothing shy about your zine.
I know. Well, that was, you know, me on the written page and me verbally is two different things. And I have been reading through in preparation for this some of the old fanzines. But it's funny, I don't have any of the originals from when I was actually living in Nashville, which is when I was actually in high school. I only saved them from when I was in college and after. So I don't actually have any of the copies that I wrote back in those times. And a lot of them were about the high school experience.
How did the idea of creating your own fanzine come to you?
Well, I always was a writer. That's always something that I've done. And I was reading and taking in a lot of... I was reading whatever was around at the time, like Adrienne Rich, Gloria Steinem, other names that I'm sorry I can't remember off the top of my head. But reading that stuff and then trying to contextualize that for a 15-year-old white teenage kid in Nashville, and like what the lived experience of being a girl in an abusive household in a regular high school with the regular, you know, double standards and pressures that girls feel in high school about sex and whatever their bodies. So just processing all of that. And one of your prep questions was the Lucy's slogan.
No racist, sexist, or homophobic shit tolerated.
So that's a lot of the stuff that I was really grappling with very earnestly. When I look back on it, I haven't figured out some of this stuff to this day. But, you know, at that age, grappling so earnestly and urgently with how racism is manifesting in my own life and how I'm privileged because of my white skin, and how sexism is manifesting in my own life and how I'm feeling the effects of that. And I think I was examining my sexuality a little bit later. I don't think in high school I really was there yet, but in the zines a little bit later I was examining that too. But I think that that tagline made me, or your slogan, and that was really on everything and really enforced, made Lucy's a very safe space for me, and a place that felt very aligned with what I was also trying to do in my life and wanted to be a part of. So, yeah.
Did your mother know you were doing the zine?
Yeah, she knew. I don't think I let her read it all from cover to cover, but she knew I was working on it. I mean, there was, you know, we lived in the same house and I was up till 2 a.m, so she had to have known I was doing something. And I didn't really, I've never, like I said, felt like I needed to hide things from my mom, but there were certain personal things that I probably didn't really want her to see that would have been too hurtful, or started conversations that, well, I mean, we had all those conversations, but maybe I just didn't want to bring them back up. I mean, we talked a lot about her decisions and the men she chose and why
she did it. You talked to her about that while you were in high school, while you were going through them.
Oh, yeah. And many, many times. I mean, no longer. I mean, it's been 30 years, so it's kind of beating my head against the wall at this point. But for a long time, yeah.
Sounds like you kind of gave up.
I mean, she's a grown woman, and I just you know, she's going to live her life the way she wants to live it. And it's not the choices that I would ever have made, but those are the choices that she's made. And it's her life, you know. And I've had to make peace with that.
Right. Do you remember anything specific you wrote about in those early issues?
Yeah. I wrote one specific thing I remember writing about was this teacher that we had in high school who was very sexually inappropriate with the girls. And, you know, a lot of it of what happened before I was around was rumors, but there were rumors about his being more actively predatory against girls. I don't know if that's true or not, but it was around. But I do know that I experienced him being very inappropriate in the classroom. And it bothered me. It bothered my friends a lot more. They were a little less accustomed to being messed with in that manner. And I actually, it was almost more on their behalf that I became so angry. But I did. I used his name. I wrote very honestly about what he was doing and how it was making people feel and why I felt the administration was turning their heads. He was like a high-level teacher, like an AP-level teacher, and all his students got good scores. But I don't think it was because of his whatever. It was a lot of excuses. And he actually got removed the next year. Not because of what I did, but because I think another student's parent threatened to go to the press. But anyway, I wrote this thing, and he saw it. And well, a lot of the girls saw it, and they were, I think, felt emboldened and felt empowered that someone was putting words to what they were feeling. But he saw it, and he grabbed me and shoved me into a book room and closed the door behind us and demanded that I print a retraction.
Holy cow.
And I refused, and it was very tense and very stressful in this closed book room with no windows.
Oh, and sounds frightening.
I mean, I'm laughing, but it was awful. I mean, it just goes to show you that it was true. I mean, not that you wouldn't believe me, but yeah, so that's one thing I wrote about. And I wrote a lot about stuff in the home life. And I wrote about, you know, as a teenage girl going to parties and the kind of stuff boys would say and what they would expect. I mean, and they would literally say, like, are you a slut? Are you a tease? You know, just shit like that from being that age and feeling so incensed by that. Like, I mean, you're giving me two choices that neither one of them are positive. So what does that say about how you feel about girls, you know? I mean, we can unpack that all day. But I wrote about stuff like that and just the day-to-day experiences. And yeah, I mean, I had by the end of it, because I think I started it, I was probably a junior, so it was just a couple of years that I was writing it that I was in high school. I had a lot of girls want to write for it and write pieces and contribute. And that was and it was girls I never would have expected. Never would have expected. Yeah. I think putting it out there just made me approachable, and because it was very raw. I talked a lot about my home life, and I mean I think it made me very vulnerable, and that made me approachable to people that had other things that they wanted to say as well.
Yeah. That vulnerability and authenticity is hard enough for an adult. Was that frightening to you as a teenager when you writing it must have felt cathartic and great.
Yeah.
But now you've written it and you have to let it out into the world. Was that hard?
I think it was. But I think there's also, you know, the classic thing of you write it. Well, in my case, you make photocopies of it, you hand it out, and you don't look at it again for a long time. So it kind of takes on a life of its own out there. And people respond however they respond. But, you know, like I think I told you I was going to read through all the old deans in preparation for this interview. And I was like, oh, God, I know it's going to be harrowing because it's just it's so earnest and it's just so emotional in a way that I feel like only a teenager can be. It's just very urgent. And like I said, really trying to dive in deep with issues that I still and like thinking I'm going to figure it out. And stuff that people, no one has figured out, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, it was scary, but not scary enough to keep me from doing it.
And did you go back
and read them? I skimmed them. I skimmed. I did not do a full deep dive.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, the writing, as I was saying earlier, it was a community and I was responding to what other girls and people were writing that was political at that time. And it's the tenor of it. It's, you know, it's, what am I trying to say? I don't think it's very nuanced in hindsight. And I think it was very, like I said, it was very angry. It was very black and white. You know, whether I was talking about the sexism I was countering with boys or interrogating myself for my white privilege or what I thought of at the time as my class privilege. You know, it was the 90s too, and it was a time when people were grappling with that. You know, we kind of go in these 20-year cycles with identity politics and whatever, and it was, we were in one of those cycles of talking about our privileges, and people would really come down on one another, and it did get kind of ugly, and it got very screed-like at times. And it's kind of hard to read, you know.
Is it, do you mean because, okay, let me put a for instance out there. So the way you and girls at the time, and to some extent, oh, to a lot of extent, actually, are treated now by boys. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that there's a certain amount of grace to be given to the perpetrators as well for that? Is that what you mean?
No.
Okay. Only because, like, it's a learned behavior. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes when you're that age, you figure it out and you grow out of it and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I behave that way, because you're, you know, a thinking, feeling human being.
I think what I'm trying to say is it was very hard line. What it maybe is, not that I felt like I owed anybody grace, but that it was just sort of screaming into the void, it felt like. I mean, obviously it wasn't a void, people were listening, but it just, I don't know. It just was very emotional in a way that I wouldn't, in a way that I wouldn't communicate now.
Yeah.
It was raw. I think raw. It was just so raw that, and vulnerable, not just about personal details about my life, but just the way that I was processing it and my emotional response. You know, I just, that's hard to read.
Yeah. Has anyone over the last 30 years reached out to you about, they found a copy or they wanted to thank you for what you've written? Like, was it 10 years, 20 years down the road?
I would say maybe 10, but not, it's been so long and those things are so far out of circulation. But yeah, I mean, at the time that I was writing them, they reached farther than I ever would have thought, and I got letters like that, I would say, up until 5 or 10 years later. And then, you know, the piece that I wrote, I don't know if this is still the case, but the piece that I wrote that was in the anthology of young feminist writers, and the book is called Listen Up, was taught in college classes for many years. I would see it on syllabi, so that was pretty gratifying. And I did get some, I didn't get letters, but I would see stuff. At that point, there was more internet stuff, and I would see things online about myself and that piece and how people loved it and excerpts from it. And
do you remember any of the letters?
Not one in particular, but, you know, they just, you know, thank you for writing this. Nobody in my town says stuff like this, that kind of thing. Like, I feel so alone. Like, thank you for, you know, writing this, and I'm so glad I found it, and yeah, makes me want to write. Can I send you my zine? So it's kind of community building.
Christine left Nashville for college in New York in 1993 when she was just 17. She may have left the town and its toxicity behind, but she didn't leave her habit of processing her anger or looking for answers through her writing. Over the next 15 years, Christine ended up in unexpected places as a writer, a student, a stripper, and as a member of the electro clash girl group WIT.
I kept writing it, and I actually was able, once I was up north into New York City in a bigger city, was able to actually connect in real life with a lot of the people that I had been corresponding with that were part of Riot Girl, and found like a real community there. And so definitely kept writing. I did a few issues of one that I called Construction Paper. And then the last one I completed, I was asked to write for it was a book, an anthology of young feminist writers. And I was asked to write a piece for that. And I did, and it was chosen and it was published. And that was excerpted into Ms. Magazine. And then they approached me later and excerpted a zine that I wrote under a pseudonym that was about my experiences as a sex worker. I was stripping at the time. So that was, and of course, like, I was coming at it from a very feminist point of view, which was something, you know, I think not a lot of people have heard that argument. So that was the other thing.
What is that argument?
Well, the argument that I made, and I stand by, was that I was, you know, working a lot of shitty, working at pizza parlors, doing whatever kind of jobs that you get when you're 19, 20, 21. And all my bosses were grabbing my ass and making all kinds of, you know, inappropriate comments. And I was like, if I'm going to get fucking treated like this, I'm going to get paid for it. If I'm going to be treated like sexualized in a piece of meat, let's just say, call it what it is, and let me get $500 a night and not $7.25 an hour, if that's even what we were making back then. Yeah. So that was my point of view, is like, let's just be transparent about what this transaction actually is.
And so there's two things. So the first would be there's that line that people say, no girl dreams of becoming a stripper when they're a kid. And that's in response to, I think, that feminist take on it.
I mean, I've heard that before. There's a lot of things kids don't dream about when they're kids because they don't know their possibilities. So I take that with a grain of salt. I guess the implication of that is that that's something that nobody would really want to do. They just fall into that, unfortunately. As a result of unfortunate circumstances. And I disagree with that. I think all the women that I worked with we're talking 20, 30 years ago, all the women that I worked with in those clubs knew what they were doing. They weren't victims of circumstance. They weren't, I mean, there's a lot of good money to be made in those clubs. Mm-hmm. And you can do it in a lot fewer hours than you would be working other jobs. So I don't know. I think the common stance is to look down on sex workers as these poor victims of circumstance who couldn't find a better way and got locked into these bad life choices is condescending and not true. And it's a way to take power out of women, taking power into their own sexuality and bartering with it. Because why not?
The experiences that you had at those other jobs, though, and women just want to go to work.
Yeah.
And not be, or school, right?
Or home.
And not be sexualized, right? Mm-hmm. Like, going to a job and having somebody comment on what you're wearing, as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's changing as women sort of step up and take power.
A little. Entirely, but
not entirely. I mean, it's changing little by little. I think again, as you know, women step up and take power in these spaces and say, "I don't want to be treated like this," or point out the double standard. I guess the question is: will the need to empower yourself by becoming a sex worker lessen as that happens?
Well, I presented my going into that line of work as a reaction to to immediate things I was experiencing. And it was partly that, but it wasn't only that. I mean, I think there was also an overarching, like, well, women are treated this way anyway, not just me and my Pizza Hut job or whatever, but just in an overarching systemic way. And that hasn't really changed. I haven't done that line of work in a long, long time, but I still, you know, as a feminist, support that line of work and follow a lot of women who are in that and who are activists in that on social media and whatnot. You know, hell, they make a lot of fucking money. Yeah. Why not? I don't see any issue with it. And I think that women will, as long as the choice is there to be made, women will continue to make it, because it's not as bad of a choice as society would like you to think that it is. Yeah. It's just stigmatized.
As long as it is a choice, though.
Right. Well, of course. I'm not talking about women that are trafficked. That's a completely different conversation. Yeah.
When and why did you end that part of your life?
Oh, a couple reasons. It was unhealthy. I was, it gave me the opportunity to do a lot of unhealthy behaviors. I won't say that it was the cause of those, but it was very easy to go into work and drink beer all day or whatever, and that wasn't healthy. I also, I think the bigger reason was that it just was very soul-sucking for reasons that are not what people think. And the reasons are that it became so apparent to me and so sad that a lot of the men that come to strip clubs, especially the ones that come regularly, and the place that I worked was a place that had a lot of regulars. It was just that kind of place. It was their only kind of human contact, the only way that they had any kind of what they considered to be intimate interaction. And that was so sad to me. And I almost felt like I was the one exploiting them. And it just felt really gross from both directions. And it just, you know, I just needed to move on.
Did you leave New York then too?
No, I did that from the ages of like 19 to 21. I was pretty young. So I got out of that.
And still
pretty
in college.
Well, I dropped out of college. I went back, but I dropped out. I went to college for 2 years and I left.
Why did you drop out?
It was personal. I came from Nashville, from a lower middle class, working class family, and the school that I went to, I mean, I was just so naive. There's so much to learn when you're that age. But the school that I went to was populated with very wealthy kids from very wealthy families, and not even the kind of wealth we see in the South, like Eastern Seaboard old money wealth. So that was a class consciousness awakening that was very difficult to navigate. That in the time that I was also navigating, that was the first time I was away from my family. And it wasn't that I missed them. It was that I had the opportunity to be away from them and be safe enough to unpack a lot of the stuff that I had just been white knuckling my way through. And all of that was just kind of unfolding. And just, I was just an emotional wreck. Let's put it that way. Yeah. So after 2 years, I needed a break. Yeah. Like, I couldn't keep up. And I, you know, of course I was on scholarships and I had to keep my GPA up fairly high, and I wasn't up to it, so I had to take a break.
So childhood trauma basically affecting the next phase of your life.
Yeah.
Wow. And then you stayed in New York, moved to New York City.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you say it that way it sounds sad, but and it was a hard time, but in the end I moved to New York City. I sort of found my people and had a really great time finding those people that had similar interests and backgrounds. And like I said, there was the Riot Girl scene, but there was also just like rock and roll queers and freaks and drag queens and trans people and gay people. And it was just like this whole world kind of opening up, and I jumped right in. And I was bartending and go-go dancing, and I was doing sex work, and you know, found my first girlfriend and all of that. It just kind of like was a leveling up and was what I needed. And I did go back and finish at that same school. And I was so glad that I did it the way that I did, because when I finished, I was living in Brooklyn and just commuting to that school. And it was so different from living in that environment with all those rich kids. I was just so, by the time I went back, I had my own life and I had my own identity. And mm-hmm. I understood myself and I felt secure. And it was easy for me to go back to that school and take advantage of what was really great about it, which was the academics. I loved the way that the academics were structured there. It was very writing heavy and it was very independent study focused. It was just the community and the social part was, it was hard for me to navigate. So once that part was taken sort of out of the picture, I had never had found my tribe before, and that's where they were. And it was very warm and welcoming, and like I felt very happy that it's like, oh my, I didn't even know these people existed, you know, like I didn't know this was here to find, and here I am finding it and thriving in it and working in this atmosphere, making all these friends, and it was great.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it was like, you know, you talk about like, yeah, I had this traumatic stuff happen, but I always felt like I went to New York in my 20s and got to have my real childhood, and it was even better than, I don't know, I can't compare, I don't know, I didn't, you know, but it was a great fun time and I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I stayed in New York for another 15 years.
Mm-hmm. What else did you do there?
Well, I finished school and then I got involved. I got into nightclub life and was working in that environment, bartending, go-go dancing, and just was around a lot of that. It's hard to describe. We don't have any kind of scene like that here, but it's just a whole ecosystem. And I had a friend who was very ambitious and imaginative and funny and smart. And she wanted to form a band. And it was right around the early 2000s. And it was the electro clash scene in New York. So it was like, it would have been Rapture. What's James Murphy's band? I always forget the name of that damn band. Death from Above is his label.
LCD?
Yeah, LCD Sound System. But all those bands were all coming out. And she was like, everybody's doing it. Let's just do a band. And so, you know, with her genius, and we got Larry T to be our producer, we formed this sort of tongue-in-cheek girl group. It was me and her and one other girl. And we went out on stage and did little dances and, like, you know, like a 60s girl group. But it was this sort of electro-clashy, very synthy. Like, when I listen to it now, it's like very trebly MIDI kind of sounding. Lyrics are ridiculous. Larry T is the gay guy. He wrote all the lyrics. So we did that for a couple of years. We toured the world. It was very fun. And then that kind of just ran its course. And I had a fabulous time, great time. But I thought, you know, I do have a college degree. And I don't know how much longer I can get on stage at 4 a.m. and sing about boys and whatever. It was just the most ridiculous lyrics. So it kind of ran its course and I was ready to move on. And then I got into teaching, and that's where I kind of went from there. So high school teaching.
What does touring the world as a electro clash 3 band member entity look like? In a van?
It's very simple, yes, because there are no instruments. You have a van and you have a big suitcase full of dresses and heels and makeup and costumes. That's about it. So we just sang over tracks.
So easy.
Yeah.
And you know, planes, trains, automobiles, whatever it takes to wherever you need to go, right? You
right.
don't have to worry about checking instruments.
No.
Oh, that's the way to do it.
Yeah. I mean, we did do the road stuff because we would travel with other bands that had actual instruments. And we would support them or whatever.
But do you have a favorite show from that time that you remember?
Oh, my gosh. That was such a fun time. We had so many favorite shows. We did, you may know the name of there's a festival in Barcelona that I think is a yearly, I mean, who knows what's happening with it now, but we did that. Huge names played it, and the fact that we even got billed on it was amazing. It was like Sonic Youth played it, magnetic fields played it, God knows who else. And to be on stage in this huge crowd, I mean, who knows who they were really waiting for, but this huge crowd was there. It was just so invigorating. It was amazing. That was a really fun one. And then we did a tour with Peaches and Chicks on Speed. That was an American tour. And a lot of those shows were really fun. We did the Fillmore. And we did some fun stuff on stage with Peaches because she was kind of the same. It's just her and a track. And I don't know if she uses instruments now, but at the time she didn't. And so it was very easy to kind of switch out and play around and pop on stage with her and do whatever.
So she was open to that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. It was her idea. Yeah.
So as a music fan, that must have been amazing, like to play those places and see the bands that you're
yes.
like, can't wait for my show to be over. I gotta go see Magnetic Fields.
Well, I remember being, I think it was that show in Spain, and I was using the bathroom, and somebody, I must not have locked it, somebody came in, and it was Kim Gordon, and I was like, it's okay. I mean, come in.
Oh my fucking God, my mom stood up in my face. I said I'm a grown ass boy, you can't talk to me in no kind of way. She steady asking me if my soul is safe. Yeah, it's in the deep freezer, it's gonna stay that way. I don't give a fuck if you're mad, you can die mad. I don't give a fuck if I'm bad, I'm finna be bad. Life is hard, baby, bless your heart. I don't give a fuck.
After 15 years in New York, Christine decided to move back to Nashville for practical reasons. A little bit of a warning here for those in the throes of an existential crisis or who may be regretting past life choices. This next part may not help. Or it might. Or both. I don't know.
And I done met these hoes and I know they're fucking trash.
What made you decide to come back to Nashville?
I just couldn't afford New York City anymore. And all of the things that I had been doing that I have, you know, mentioned earlier that are things that can only happen in New York City, I wasn't doing those things anymore. I wasn't working in nightclubs. I wasn't even really going to nightclubs. You know, I changed my life substantially by becoming a teacher. And one of the beauties of that job is you can do it anywhere. And so I was with a partner at the time and we both wanted to leave New York and we had different options on the table about where we might go. And they really liked Nashville. I brought them back here and they, you know, it's such an unfair comparison coming back to someplace like Nashville from New York, like in March, where New York in March is just awful. It's gray and cold and ugly and slush filled and disgusting and depressing, and it's been winter for 6 months and you can't stand it and you don't know how you're ever going to do this again. Like, and then you come to Nashville and March is beautiful and the trees are budding and air is soft and it smells like flowers and everything's green. Yep. And I remember clearly we came back here and we were like, Jesus, I don't want to go back. Can we just send for our things?
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, moving back to Nashville is one of those decisions that I think back and I think, did I make the right decision? I'm sorry to say it, but I don't know. Here I am.
So do you think about leaving?
I don't, because it took me a long time to find a community here. And I think the older you get, the harder that becomes. And I don't have a partner now. And if I did move somewhere, it would most likely be alone or, I guess, with a friend. And it's so hard, I think. And I think so Nashville has a lot of stuff about it that we don't like and that we would like to change. But one thing that I like, the things about it that are great are the things that are really easy to take for granted and to overlook. And I think it's family and friends, a family of friends. I think it's quality of life, even as it gets harder here and it gets harder everywhere. It's still easier here than it was in New York, which is my point of comparison. So every place has its pros and cons. So I think you just kind of make peace with where you are and what you're working with and do your best with it.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I am. But I do wonder if I'd stayed in New York or if I decided to move. I think the other place we were thinking about was Philadelphia, what it would be like now. There's a kind of loneliness here, I think. You know, there's just a lack of culture kind of all around that feels sort of lonely.
Because in New York, as soon as you step out of on the street, you get a burst of energy from the things around you.
And I mean, bam, street fashion. Bam, whatever song is playing that summer, you're hearing it on every stoop. I mean, it's just, there's so much life. Yeah. And life is lived so sort of atomized here and in your car and in your house and with your family and with, you know.
What made you decide to stop teaching?
God, where to begin? I love teaching. I mean, it's a wonderful profession. But as we've seen, you know, teachers are just undercut, not by the students, not by the families, but by politicians and policymakers, just every step of the way, frontline on everything, just constantly more on the plate and less in the pocket. And so it was all of that. And then I also just was in a job, the job that I had in the school that I was at, I felt pretty stagnant. There wasn't any kind of leadership role that I wanted to move into. And so, you know, people don't tell you how long your working life is, you know, and I hit 40 and realized that I had like 30 more years to work. After I finished having a panic attack about that.
Panic attack check, existential crisis
yeah,
check.
Exactly. Breathing into a bag for a while. I would just thought, do I want to sit here and just rot in this job? I mean, it was a decent job. The money was fine. The job wasn't difficult any longer. You know, I had been doing it for 17 years at that point. But I just thought, I just can't imagine just sitting here rotting in this job for the next 30 years. Like, I'm bored. Like, there's so much more living to do. And so I gave myself, I think, a 3-year plan of I'm going to figure out what's next. It turned into a 2-year plan when COVID hit. And I jumped out of that in part because of the way that the school that I was working in handled going back made me very uncomfortable. And I didn't, didn't really want to participate in that. So I jumped, and here's where I am now.
When Christine jumped, she landed at Nashville Software School and is currently working in Nashville as a software engineer. Thanks so much for listening. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at their official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you want more info about any of the Lucy's podcast episodes, you can visit the show notes or go to lucysrecordshop.com. You can also follow at Lucy's Record Shop on Twitter, Instagram, or join the Lucy's community over on Facebook. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the outro music. Thanks again for listening.